All right, let's go ahead and get started. The agenda is here. Today on the agenda, we have a discussion on the state of the JSON-LD documents and whether or not we think we're going to be able to get into last call with all the documents we have, and then a whole bunch of issues for the JSON-LD API, issues that mostly have proposals down, and there's been some discussion, so I hope we can get through a decent chunk of them today. Are there any updates or changes to the agenda, anything that should be modified? Marcus, would you mind scribing today?
No, sure. No problem.
Thanks. All right. All right, let's go ahead and get started then. First on the agenda is the state of the JSON-LD documents. Again, thanks to your great work, Marcus, I think we're in fairly good shape as far as the JSON-LD syntax document is concerned. I still have hope that we can get through the JSON-LD API document before the end of January. And if not, we should be able to get it to LC by February at the very, very latest. But there are some things that we need to discuss about the document. So I think the only outstanding thing for the JSON-LD syntax document is the ABNF that you worked up, Marcus. And I do agree with Greg and what some of the other folks on the list have said. It is useful. It really succinctly kind of describes JSON-LD. The minor downside to it is that it's not in any kind of standard W3C notation, we don't want people to think that just because they don't match that grammar that it is an invalid JSON-LD document, like it would not be parsed. But those are fairly easy to kind of explain in prose in the spec. So that's the syntax document. I think we still need to make a grammatical pass over the syntax document and make sure that we're explaining things well and it flows well. We've done a number of those passes over the past 6 months, but we just need to make another one of those before we have a last call ready document. And I think we can definitely do that before the end of the month. So I think JSON-LD syntax is definitely going to go to last call by the end of this month, unless the RDF working group blocks it for whatever reason. The JSON-LD API document is a little more unknown. I believe that we are feature complete. The JSON-LD API is almost feature complete after the resolutions we make today, hopefully. But the major discussion now is happening around the algorithms and whether the algorithms should be more descriptive than prescriptive. We're basically trying to make the algorithms easy to understand for readers while not leaving any ambiguity. And that's always a difficult and iterative process. But I think that from the look of the mailing list and the discussions that have happened and the edits that are happening, I think we're on a good path. Right. I think that the base layer that Marcus did was great. I think the edits and the modifications that Greg is making is great. So, you know, I think we'll just have to iterate on it a couple more times to get something that all of the editors and the group kind of agrees on. And I think that's really the major outstanding bit of work that the group has to do, which isn't that bad. I don't think it's that bad. So all that said, any additions that you guys want to make, Marcus or Greg or Francois?
Nope.
Okay, so I guess next steps would be just working on the algorithms. I think I'm going to try and make the grammatical prose pass for the syntax document and prep that for last call. That's going to be my first priority, just to get one of those documents into last call. And then when Greg has feels that he's finished on his algorithm pass, I think Dave Longley and I will make another pass to kind of look at the two side by side and see which one at least we tend to prefer, and then maybe implement that in the spec.
I completed the work on my alternative version of the algorithms document here, which can be compared directly with, I believe, what's on the, it's the 1225 timestamp version,
okay.
Which the other one was not check against that one.
Okay.
So that allows it to be compared a little bit better. I think as I outlined in emails, I wanted to try to see if we could stay a little closer to the original algorithms without having to change an awful lot of different concepts, such as an inverse context, in order to make sense of it, and remove a lot of the specifics about when an error should be raised and what the error code is, which, in my opinion, doesn't belong in the algorithm expression, but is part of the API.
Yep, I agree to all of that in general. Marcus, have you had a chance to look over Greg's alternative algorithms yet?
I had a brief look at it, and, I don't know if I misunderstood the algorithms or if I really found some issues, but I think, for example, the new annotation container or all that stuff, I don't think it's really properly specified in those alternate algorithms. And I'm also not that sure that we should include those must statements, those normative must statements in algorithms for kind of validation checks, because those are already in the syntax spec, in the grammar, so we don't need to duplicate them. And
statements, what algorithm are you referring to?
Well, for example, let me check it. Basically, you remove the error handling and replace that with must, for example.
Right.
In the expansion algorithm, point 2.3, if the active properties container mapping is set to at least, the expanded item must not be an array or a list object.
And that's duplicating a similar statement in the syntax document.
I think so, for example.
Yeah. Right.
And there are a lot of musts in the expansion algorithm, for example.
Yeah, I think what I was attempting to do was to replace a similar expression that would say that it need to raise an error with something that was sort of would act as a hook for the API to be able to say if the expectation is violated in 2.3, then raise this exception. So if there's some way to rephrase that to act as a place where we note something that is not expected, then that would be fine with it not being totally normative text.
Yeah, I understand the motivation, but as I said, I'm not really sure that's the right direction, and that's also the reason why I didn't put in call the error handler passing that error code. I just said pass raise that error. So I just kind of, it's still separated from the API. It's just that you enumerate explicitly the error the way I have it in currently in the algorithms I've wrote.
Yeah, and I didn't want to be explicit about an error either. So, but we could put in something that, you know, if this is found, then the algorithm goes into error recovery mode or something. I want to be ambiguous about the detail of what happens for an API, but also be able to identify that this is a location where some action might be taken.
Yeah, it's kind of a strange issue, right? Because we want to make it easy for implementers so that they don't really have to think about where errors could be raised, you know, when they're doing an API implementation. But at the same point, you know, exception throwing and error handling and all that kind of stuff should probably not be a part of the core algorithms. So there's got to be, I'm sure, around. We just need to figure out what that is. And it could be what Greg just said. You know, we say, if this is detected, then the thing should go into error recovery. And we might even point to the error that it should, kind of throw, point directly in the spec to the error somehow, you know. Anyway, I feel that that's kind of a detail that we can work out later. It's not, you know, it's not a major disagreement we're having. It's just we need to figure out the best way to do it. Okay. So, Marcus, from what you're saying, it sounds like there are potentially a couple of things missing from Greg's algorithms. And we just need to make a couple of passes over that to make sure what those are, to see what those are. But that's assuming that, you know, neither I nor Dave Longley have looked at in detail at Greg's alternative algorithms. So we'll have to do that to see if that's the direction we want to go, or if we want to just keep the algorithms you have there, Marcus. But from what I understand, Greg, your algorithms are already kind of a hybrid of what Marcus had there, and you went in and modified a couple of them. Some of them heavily, some of them not that much. Is that right?
Yeah. So I sort of summarized it. I think the expansion algorithm is pretty much the same expansion algorithm that Marcus has, although I did not separate using the active context and the local context, but merge the two together and then operate over a local context, which I think simplifies things. I think it's correct in the way it operates as well, but there's that. So the expansion algorithm is pretty, it's definitely very similar in intent to what Marcus's was. Context processing, I think, had some simplifications to it, mostly because we're not as explicit over the ways in which IRI expansion is called, and we leave it to be a more, for instance, relative to vocabulary mapping rather than passing the vocab relative flag. In general, I tried to get away from describing specific flags and values and rather calling the operations with an intention.
Okay.
The IRA expansion, that used a lot, it was actually, I think, not entirely correct in either the old one or in Marcus's, in terms of its need to be able to recurse over the contents in order to make sure that all of the pieces get fully expanded without causing a recursion. So there were two different mechanisms that were done here. This changes it basically to say it must not result in repeatedly expanding the same prefix, which has the same effect without prescribing a mechanism by which you do that.
Right. Okay.
And then I think most of the changes are more on compaction. The compaction algorithm is much closer to the original compaction algorithm with a separate pass starting at 0.6 on iterating over property generators to compact those before we go and we process each element. And then the IRI compaction continues to use the term rank with some small updates made to term rank. So I know that Mark in particular wasn't happy with sort of using somewhat arbitrary numeric values in term rank in order to get a result. And I think if we come up with a better way of stating how that process happens in term rank, I'd be fine with that. But I felt having sort of a term rank algorithm that was used as part of the compaction simplified that, the way that compaction is expressed, rather than the inverse context. I just got to be very difficult for me to follow otherwise.
Okay. Well, I mean, like I said, at a high level, it sounds like a good direction. Devil's in the details, of course, so we'll get back to you guys once we have a chance to read over that stuff. Any other concerns with the documents at a high level? Any other high-level concerns about either the JSON-LD syntax document or the API document going the last call?
There are the to and from RDF algorithms, which aren't updated yet. I mean, they are. I didn't review them yet, but probably they should work without much changes. But they could be simplified quite a lot if we would run them by first flattening the document instead of working directly on the expanded document. So I don't know if we should simplify that or not.
Wait, say that again. If we do.
So, for example, if you are converting JSON-LD to RDF, we are currently just expanding the document, and then we are running the to RDF algorithm. And there is quite a lot of duplication in there because we do most of the work already in flattening. So we could simplify the to RDF algorithm by first flattening the document and then running the remaining work.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not that awfully many steps. There certainly is. It's recursive in that regard. So there might be something to be gained by going flattening, and it would seem that operating over a flat document would achieve much of that. The only changes that I needed to make. That aren't probably described explicit in here is to make sure that when we're creating new B nodes that it sort of continues using the B node generator that it did through the expansion phase, because otherwise I was creating a repeated B node, and when triples are output after having gone through a graph element, that going back through that graph element ends up creating a blank node, which makes it look like all of the quads in the default graph have a name that's a blank node. And that's certainly not the case. So I basically just modified my processor to not output a name if the blank node, which certainly means that there could be a place where you specifically wanted to use a blank node, but you didn't get it out. On the other hand, RDF doesn't allow blank nodes to be graph names, so it doesn't really lose anything with respect to RDF.
Okay. Do you think that we should? Well, anyway, I think we can. You're going to make another pass over the algorithms just to make sure that they're right, or maybe put some hint about that in there, Greg?
Well, they are certainly right in the sense that I implement them and I pass all of our tests, so they're right with respect to the current test suite. I don't know of something that would make wrong output from them. I think the issue is if we were to flatten, could we then simplify the two RDF algorithm? And if we could achieve some significant simplification, then that would be a useful thing to look at. And yeah, I can take a look at that.
One of the things that we're definitely going to want to put in the API spec is to say that the algorithms, the intent of the algorithms are probably not going to change unless it's to fix a bug after a last call. But some of the algorithms may be reworked during last call to make them easier to understand for developers. So that would allow us to kind of push that work, the flattening work, off until we're in last call or after last call. Typically, we want to do that with these algorithms, because, I mean, they can be changed multiple times, you know, during last call, or I'm sure we're going to find bugs later on, and we don't want that to trigger another last call or some kind
of
fairly simple.
Yeah. I do not pass hardly any of the flattening specs, which I used to pass them all. So one of the reasons is that the existing spec will generate blank nodes without properties, rather nodes without properties, and the old version did not. I think we've decided that we don't want to do that, so I think the algorithm must have gone through a fair change at some point that I haven't tried to update to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we can decide on the dropping these top-level propertyless nodes, that'll get us closer back to, I think, at least the way that my algorithm's currently working.
Okay.
My flattening algorithm was simply a implementation of the one that Marcus had specified, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, Marcus, did you go through and make a lot of changes to the flattening algorithm since then?
Not really. The only difference is that now the graphs are included in the flattening in the flattened output, whereas before you always just returned one graph at a time.
I thought there was an option that would do that.
No, we decided to always include all the graphs.
Yeah. So yeah, there's something in that that I haven't looked at enough, so I'm not completely up to date with regards to flattening. But I think that looking on the expected test output, it needs to be updated, assuming we resolve to not output propertyless nodes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a separate issue we are going to discuss today, right?
Yeah. Okay, anything else high level on the two documents before we move into the issues?
Only one other thing that's worth thinking about. I made some changes to the HTML plus RDFA document, and there was some added implementation in the TREF or TDEF tags that we make use of, which make it much easier to reference terms which are defined in a different document. So we have a lot of, in our term definition area, a lot of things that are repeated from the syntax document. So if we were to do this, we could remove a lot of those definitions from the algorithms document and just have them go back to the syntax document.
That would be great. I think that would be very helpful. One of the reasons we had them in that document is so people didn't have to flip back and forth between them. So we could redefine them but point them back to the other document, or we could just point them back to the other document. It might be helpful to have them all in one document, don't you think?
The problem has been keeping them synchronized.
Thank you. Well, I mean,
and
we can try
it. We are duplicating stuff, so.
Yeah, well, we could try pointing back to the other spec and see how that reads. I don't really have a strong opinion on it. It's, you know, my greatest concern is that it would make the document more difficult to read for implementers.
Couldn't we include it as non-normative and, well, just as a copy and then normatively reference the syntax spec if there are any misalignments?
Yeah, we could. I mean, it's kind of like editorial, you know.
Yeah.
It's an editorial sleight of hand that I don't think, and none of the readers are going to understand that, I don't think.
Well, I think the issue is if there's not a, if we don't define string and array and JSON object, but we continue to use them as such, the reason they were all linked terms anyway is so you can easily get to the definition.
Yeah.
So it does have the same effect, except that it would just open it at that point in a different document. So
let's try that. I mean, you know, it's worth giving it a shot and seeing how it. You know, I don't think that. I'm thinking about it a bit more, and if I were reading a document and there was just, you know, some word there that I didn't understand, I'd just click on it and see what the definition was. I don't think I would really care where it was defined. And I don't think that reading the full chunk of definitions at the beginning of the document, I wouldn't retain that while I was reading the rest of the document. At least that's my personal take on it. So, I mean, yeah, let's go ahead and let's see if we can rip that section out of there and just reference the other document.
Okay. I'd rather not start to make that change until we reconcile it, because we now have two different documents, and
sure,
we make
yeah.
changes in one and not the other. It will introduce some more problems. So
yeah.
I think as soon as we've resolved how to go forward with that, then I'd be happy to go through and make that pass.
Yeah, and this is an editorial change, so we can make it at any point before rec. It doesn't have to be before last call. Okay. Anything else on the docs before we move into the issues? All right. Issue 153, defining the error handler behavior. Link to that issue is here. I went through and rather than kind of talking it out in the issue tracker, I tried to just implement all the text to see how difficult it would be. And then once I did that, I was like, well, it'd be a shame to lose the text. So I just went ahead and committed it. I believe the text that I put into the spec addresses all of the concerns that were there. And I put in a proposal into the issue tracker to adopt the spec text as is. Marcus has some concerns with the spec text. Primarily, I think, Marcus, you said that you don't feel that there's a need for these different levels of errors, and in a lot of cases the information is only useful for linters and validators. And then you said that you also see an argument that we might want to standardize the issue codes, but also mentioned that there's a lot of work with no clear advantage in doing that. So I guess the question is, one, do we want to standardize the issue codes, or is there a set of issue codes that we want to standardize? And let's see, you said with this information it wouldn't be possible to use a JSON-LD processor for a linter anyway. Which I don't really understand. So maybe, Marcus, you can kind of outline some of your concerns with this approach.
Just a sec.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, basically, the thing is that we have now two error handling mechanisms. One is for the critical errors, where the processor will stop. And the second one is the issue callback handler, as I think you called it, which is used for warnings and what was the other thing?
It's used for warnings and non-fatal errors.
Yeah, exactly. And basically, that's, in my opinion, it's kind of debug output because you can't really do anything useful with it. And even if it probably is nice to have that debug output, in the end, it wouldn't help you at all. Because, for example, if you are implementing a linter or a validator or something, the provided information is by no means enough to do anything useful with it. Because you just have that error code, the level, and an optional debug message. But for example, you can't track back that message to a specific location in the document where that error was triggered, or yeah, basically that's it. So you can't implement, for example, a validator which then highlights the parts which cause errors or problems. And so I don't think it really makes sense to specify that out, because I think it potentially harms more than it really brings us. So I would propose that we say something in the spec that options, the JSON-LD options object that we have, can be extended by concrete implementations, so it's not kind of sealed. And of course, every implementation is free to add other debugging or monitoring functionality. But we just specify the conditions where a JSON-LD processor stops continuing processing, and we also specify the error codes which are returned in that case.
So one of the issues that I've always had with JSON is that they didn't specify a mechanism like this. So when you are processing a JSON document, the only error that you ever get is parsing failed. Right? So you don't know what caused a processing error. You don't know any of that information. So I think that it is, and this is useful for developers that are using the language. It's not just when you need to lint the document. It's, you know, at runtime, if something fails, you want some kind of output to say, hey, you know, processing failed for this reason, or you have a number of warnings in this document that you should probably pay attention to. And, you know, maybe a large chunk of developers won't care about that. They won't need that, but that, the group of developers that would like to see that, or would like to see warnings, or would like to see non-fatal errors, I think is fairly significant when you're developing a system. So when you put it into production, it might not be that interesting to you, but when you're actually developing, it's actually very, very useful, because you want to know why, you know, certain things aren't happening correctly. And without this mechanism, you wouldn't have no way of knowing that. I mean, it would be a completely non-standard mechanisms for figuring out what went wrong. I also don't think that we need to standardize every issue code. We don't need to standardize every warning. We don't need to standardize every error. we may have a basic set that we can think of in the beginning, just keep it as a small set, and then over time we may define more of those as implementers, you know, implement more of the codes. So I think that we could let it work more organically grow, which means that there wouldn't be that much of a implementation burden for us as spec writers in the beginning, and we could kind of grow the issue codes over time. The other thing is, you know, you don't have a pointer to where the error happened, line number, and all that kind of stuff. But the problem is that we don't have that because JSON doesn't provide that. The JSON API stuff doesn't provide that in most cases. So the most that we could do is just have like a details object where the processor tries to put as much extra information in there as possible. And we could say, look, the error objects, you can put a whole bunch of extra information in the error objects. These are just the minimum required fields. So if a processor somehow can get the line number where the error happened, or they can get, you know, the key value where it happened, which they can do, then the developer should, the implementer for the RDFA processor definitely should put that information in the error. So I think the part where we can tell people that they can extend the object, isn't necessarily just at JSON-LD options. I think we should definitely tell people they can extend JSON-LD options, but I think we should tell people that they can also extend the JSON-LD processor issue object, such that more information can be put in there, more debugging information can be put in there. And speaking more to like whether or not this is useful, I think it's very useful to have the debugging, you know, the ability to debug input, even if it's just warnings or just non-fatal errors. It's, you know, I know when we're developing systems, we want to be able to see problems like that, so we know that we're actually, so our output is good. We have decent output. So that's just my two cents on the on this issue. Anyone else have input? Greg, Francois?
Well, I think it's useful to be able to do these things. It's when we become too prescriptive on, which is sort of an exercise when you itemize all of the different error codes with a different error code for every possible place that an error might be found. That starts to feel a little burdensome. So I guess my feeling is that the errors should be more generic. For instance, you know, evaluation, context, syntax error, something like that. And then with allow the implementation to provide some other textual description of what's going on there. But then that provides a similar mechanism to do informative or debug types of output messages, which I use in all of my processors as well, and expose it through my distiller, and I find it to be quite useful. Just not necessarily in the way that it would be done using the JSON-LD API, but I actually don't. I'm not going to try to do a strict implementation of the JSON-LD API because I don't think it makes as much sense in the Ruby context.
Mm-hmm. So, Marcus, would you be more okay with something that had more general errors for the error codes? So the fatal error codes, we're going to be very specific on those. But for things like warnings or non-fatal errors, we can be fairly generic, such as, you know, grammar error or, you know, syntax error or context error, and just kind of leave it at that.
Well, I mean, it's still the same question. Why do we need that? Or why do we need to specify that? I see the need in concrete implementations, but I don't see why we need to specify that, because you can't I mean, you don't achieve any interoperability by specifying it. So what's the point of doing that exercise?
Well, the interoperability is that there is a mechanism for reporting warnings and non-fatal errors. That's where the interoperability is. I don't think we're going for interoperability down to the codes for the warnings. We definitely need interoperability for the codes for the fatal errors, but I don't think we need interoperability for the codes for the warnings or the codes for the non-fatal errors.
Yeah, I agree with that. But if someone then needs some other mechanism for debugging, do they have to implement that generic debugging interface plus their additional proprietary debugging interface? So they probably end up with two callbacks then in the end, or I don't know.
Why can't they just extend the one that's there, the issue handler?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe they can, maybe they can't. But
well, what I'm saying is that they can. That's how they do it, is they just extend the issue handler that's there. And they'd add extra properties if they needed it. They would be more specific. They'd give line numbers in the issue object. That's how they do it.
Yeah. I mean, you could also just log to the console, for example, when you turn on debugging.
Yeah, I mean, if they wanted to, they could have something in the JSON-LD options that allowed you to, you know, log to the console. They wanted to do that, but I don't think that's a standard way of doing any kind of error reporting in any of these libraries. You never just printf your errors, right?
Yeah, that's true, but I mean, we are nowhere in the algorithms we specify where warnings should be thrown. So we just have an interface but don't describe how it should be used. And in the end, every implementation will look completely different than in the end.
They will all have the issue callback. They call the same callback, maybe,
but they call it at different times. They call it in different circumstances.
Yep. And I think that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't see any value in it, and that's why I would like to simplify it.
Well, the alternative is to not have it at all, right?
Well, not have it specified.
Which is the same thing as not having it at all in the spec. It's not specified at all in the spec. So the way that you get warnings and issues is not specified at all in the spec.
Just if you get fatal errors, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't like that, because then there's no clear way for somebody to say, okay, I'm just going to dump everything that comes out of this, out of the issue callback, because I don't really know what I'm doing with JSON-LD, and I want to just make sure that I catch everything that the processor is complaining about. That part becomes just processor specific at that point, and I don't think that's, you know, we're talking about like one entry in an options object. I don't think it's that much of a burden for the spec to just put that out there. I mean, it is, and it's like it's a couple of lines of text in the spec. And I'd much rather say that this is the JSON-LD, this is the way, if you need to catch warnings or errors in a JSON-LD processor, just listen to this callback and print everything out. That's how you do it. Versus it's totally up to the implementation, because I feel that a lot of implementations are going to do what the JSON implementation did and not provide it at all. And the downside of that is that then you have a system that's not very useful for debugging what the error is. Like, for example, the JSON-LD playground, we just listen, we quite literally catch exceptions that come from the processor, and we're like, oh, there was an exception, there's a parsing error, comma missing, that's it. Like, there's no idea where the comma was missing, there's, you know, no instruction on there's no instruction of any kind of where the error happened, and so you have to start this guessing game of what the issue actually was. And I just look at that as a really big failure of JSON for not specifying that.
So that would mean the other way around, it would mean that every implementation has to include that callback.
Yes.
Even if it's never called.
Yep. But that's a bad implementation. If you're not gonna tell your implementers why there are problems with the output, you've got a bad JSON-LD processor implementation. Or at least user friendly one.
I mean, everything was completed successfully. Those are just diagnostics. It's just diagnostic output.
Yeah, but the diagnostic output might tell you that, oh, there was a term that you thought was defined that isn't defined, and the developer's really confused as to why half their output is disappearing, right? If you didn't have that issue reporting mechanism, they would just half the output's disappearing. I have no idea why. And it's because there was a term that they thought they had specified that isn't specified. If they had that issue callback, they would figure that out very quickly. If they did not have the issue callback, they would start having to kind of hunt around and kind of understand how the JSON-LD processor works to find out that, oh, I have a missing term, right? It's those kinds of – I feel it's those kinds of errors and issues that differentiate languages that are easy to use from ones that are not. When you have a decent bit of, like, you know, it's the difference between GCC and Clang. So when you use Clang and you compile something, the errors that you get back are really, really nice. It tells you exactly where things went wrong, and they're just warnings, you know. But some of those warnings are really important. Whereas when you get an error back from GCC, who knows if that's actually where the error happened. In the early days of GCC, you know, it would just tell you completely the wrong thing of where the error happened, and it would make debugging, you know, your program much, much harder. So as you can probably tell, I'm a very big fan of letting the developer know when things might be going wrong. It's better to be verbose about, you know, this stuff than just kind of leave it as an exercise to implementers.
Okay. Well, yeah, those are two different opinions.
So unless
see the value, I just don't understand why we need to specify such a thing. But I'm fine with including it if you think it's really that valuable.
Okay, I definitely think it's that valuable. Greg, I don't know, Greg or Francois, can you two like weigh in on this so it's just not Marcus and I kind of going back and forth on this?
Well, I agree that for a processor, having the ability to get good error output is useful, but I'm not sure that means that the spec needs to be written such that every processor will always give useful output, that it can turn into a competitive advantage of one processor versus the other. Some of my own parsers, for instance, Turtle and Sparkle, they are accurate in terms of outputting errors, but the errors aren't very helpful, and that's just because when all you have to go through is branch tables, it doesn't always show you something which is going to make sense to a developer. So if those specifications had been written such that you had to be very precise about the types of errors you come across, it would have made the process of writing those much more complicated. And the fact that there are JSON or Sparkle processors that are better at doing that provides those processors with a competitive advantage. So I don't really see why at the specification level we needed to be so specific about the specific errors and, you know, how they're reported.
Okay, but there's an important differentiation to make here. So we're not saying we're going to be very specific about the errors, the warnings and errors. We have to be specific about the fatal errors, but warnings and errors we're not going to be very specific about, right? So that's one part of what I believe you just said. The other part is you don't believe that we should specify that there's a callback for warning or error reporting?
I'm not sure that is. I'm not sure that's necessary. And like I say, in my own case with Ruby, the more specific we get over the needs of the JSON-LD API, the less it feels like the JSON-LD API is particularly important for Ruby, because Ruby has different idioms of doing things. It certainly can implement it along the lines of the API, but that's not the way that people write Ruby programs. So is that the way, you know, should we try to be something specific for the sake of adhering to a cross-language way of doing processing, or should we try to do, you know, provide access to the algorithms in a real Ruby idiomatic way? So, like I said, I'm moving much more towards that latter position.
Right.
The specifics about error callbacks are, I mean, I have a standard way of doing these types of callbacks across my other languages, which makes more sense for me to try to stick with.
Right, and I think that's a general agreement. One piece of text that I upgraded in the API, the JSON-LD API spec, was to basically say that the API is meant to be implemented in JavaScript, period. Right, so there's no, we don't have that kind of weasel wording in the beginning of the API section that says, well, you might want to implement this in Python and Ruby. We just straight out say, look, this is meant to be implemented in JavaScript, because a lot of the callback mechanisms we have are very, like, idiomatic to JavaScript, really. Francois, you want to?
Yeah, you asked me to weigh in, so that's what I'm about to do. I guess I'm on the same. I share the view that markets has, and it might be best left to the implementation. In the end, what we're talking about is the issue callback property, right? The option property. You could think of other ways to do that. For instance, you could use events, and some people really love events, and you could imagine having some kind of a warning events triggered by the JSON-LD processor when it encounters a warning that is not a fatal error. And that would be a good implementation of a JSON-LD processor in my view, but still wouldn't respect the spec as you envision it. So it's not a big deal if the property ends up being defined spec, because it doesn't change the API in itself. It's really just a property in an options checked. So it's not that fundamental in a way to the API, so I wouldn't fight over it. But I guess it's, in my view, best handled by implementations. It's good to be willing to have good implementations, but in the end, the developers will develop that, these implementations, and you can't do much in a spec to impose, to restrict, to constrain them into doing something good.
So if we get rid of the issue callback, there will no longer be warnings and non-fatal errors.
So my view would be, I wouldn't keep it for warnings.
Wait, say that again?
I wouldn't keep the issue callback property in the spec.
Okay. I'm just saying that because,
of course,
Greg,
I would keep the fatal error. That's
right. Okay. Greg, you were the one of the people that said that you wanted there to be, you know, multiple levels of errors. But if we remove the issue callback, there will be, that will no longer be true. We're going to just have fatal errors. That's it.
Yes. I get that. I don't see how we can. Another way to view it is to say that we spent already quite a some time on this and still haven't come up with a satisfactory solution. Well, I haven't proposed a solution, so I'm not the one who can blame anyone. But the still, it may be an indication that it's not any easily solved, and maybe as it can be left to implementations without breaking the API.
Okay.
I wouldn't specify it this time.
Okay.
Again, it's not reduced. I mean, it's not a plus one or minus one. It's more a minus 0.2, if you want.
Okay, all right, so then the proposal is to modify the spec text, modify the current spec text to remove the issue callback from JSON-LD options, but keep the rest of the error handling mechanism. And I think this basically simplifies it such that it's what Marcus, I believe, is proposing. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Except the JSON-LD API spec text on error handling one modification. Remove the issue callback from JSON-LD options. Okay. So that's the proposal.
So we keep that severity property?
Yeah, I guess we wouldn't need to, huh?
I mean, there is just
yeah.
one type of severity.
Yeah.
That's exactly.
And remove severity from JSON-LD issue. And we could probably rename JSON-LD issue to just JSON-LD error.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm typing this up right now. Accept JSON is few modifications from okay. So that. What do you mean by inline like the rest, Marcus?
Well, we have JSON-LD callback, we have JSON-LD options, we have JSON-LD...
Oh, I got you. Okay. Yep. So I'll change that in the resolution.
Oh, yeah. There was a missing space.
Okay. That's resolved. Next issue up is issue 178, which is renaming the JSON-LD API and JSON-LD core processing specs there. And the proposal that seems to have broad agreement is Marcus's proposal 6, which is to, let's see, which is to rename the JSON-LD syntax spec to JSON-LD 1.0, a JSON-based serialization for linked data. in the API spec to JSON-LD 1.0 processing algorithms and API. Marcus, you're saying without a subtitle, but I think per W3C we're required to have a subtitle for the spec. That may not be true, but Francois, if you don't think you've seen probably more specs than I have, we might not be, we might not have to. We could just name it JSON-LD 1.0 algorithm. Go ahead.
I'm definitely not sure that I've seen more specs than you have, but I don't think that's a required that's a requirement. You don't have to have subtitles, as far as I know, unless rules have changed. But we can, that can be easily found out.
Okay, well, we'll try no subtitle and then see if we hit any issues. Okay, so the proposal is this, rename JSON-LD.
So along that, we'll have, I presume, JSON-LD syntax as a short name stays, but we'll want to change the short name for the algorithms and API.
Yeah. We'll, we can, we, I mean, you know, we can kind of bike shed this later, but one of us will make the change to the docs. We'll take a look at it, and if it looks okay, then we'll keep it. If it doesn't, we'll muck around with the title and subtitle bit. But the short name will stay JSON-LD syntax, and the short name will stay JSON-LD-API. But the title of the docs will be what we're putting in here, what we've just resolved them to. That makes sense.
Could we have also short name just JSON-LD?
So yes, we could. We would have to request a new short name from Thomas, and I'm actually going through that process with them for the RDFA specs. So I could. Do we want to try and shift the short name to JSON-LD? And JSON-LD-syntax. Sometimes it's good to have more descriptive names in the short name, because they might come up with a JSON-LD primer in the future. And actually, you know what? I don't know.
It's sort of why I was thinking that the JSON-LD API might change, since the focus of the document really isn't on the API now. It's on the algorithms. So if anything, JSON-LD algorithms or JSON-LD core processing, something like that, might make more sense down the line. In terms of the title, I mean, we do have both algorithms and API in the title. It's possible we might have just used what we have now as JSON-LD algorithms and then put the API aspect of that into the subtitle, which would allow us to sort of keep to a simpler message.
Say the second part of that again, Greg.
Well, so I know we just voted on JSON-LD algorithms and API, but that is sort of a mouthful. And if we just say, if it was just JSON-LD algorithms, the way that Marcus has it written now, and then we add something about the API into the subtitle, it sort of shows that the weight of the document is on the algorithms. it allows you to find the API aspect of it in bibliographic references, but it makes it clearer that the core is the algorithms, and therefore that a short name could be JSON-LD algorithms.
What do you think, Marcus? I kind of like that.
Sorry, I was crying. I couldn't really follow. So what?
So Greg's basically saying the subtitle in the we would have, here we go. So we would have JSON LD short name is JSON LD title is. And then I think Kingsley's going to flip out over the title, but that's fine. He will be the only one that does so. And then I forget what the subtitle for – no, it's JSON-LD1.0, and then the subtitle is a JSON-based serialization for linked data. Sorry. So that means that this is the title, subtitle – and then short name, JSON LD algorithms, title is this, subtitle is processing. Maybe something like that. I don't know exactly if that's what we'd want, but
the only problem I see with that is that if you Google for it, you wouldn't find JSON-LD API, for example. Or, well, it would rank worse because it's not in the title.
Yeah. Okay, so... let's just do no subtitle. Let's just do what we resolved for now. Greg, if that's okay with you.
Okay.
And then we can tweak it later on. I don't want us to spend too much extra time on this today. Is that okay with you, Greg?
Yeah, it's fine.
Do you want to change the short name though?
Well, yeah, I don't know if we're going to keep so basically it's going to be JSON-LD algorithms and API with JSON-LD API as the short name.
Well, Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. I think if we were to do it from scratch, we would probably not. We would probably put the emphasis on the algorithms and say JSON-LD algorithms or JSON-LD processing.
Yeah. Let's put it out as a straw poll on the issue tracker and see what other folks think. Let's go down. I mean, I think the document titles are fine. What we just resolved is fine. But let's go down and do short name, title, subtitle, short name, title, subtitle for both documents and get input from folks on that. And we can just put it in the same issue if that works.
Okay.
All right, so this issue isn't resolved, but mostly because we're just kind of bite shedding the short names and other things like that. Okay, next topic is issue 205, compacting IDs to relative IRIs. In there's a link to the issue. It's issue 204. I think we have broad agreement to not allow terms as values for IDs. Is that correct? Does anyone disagree with that? And then we have an extension proposal from Marcus.
There's also a question of whether we then allow queries for IDs.
Yeah. Okay, so let's deal with those in two different steps. So the first one is not to allow terms as values for IDs. Okay. Now, the next one is something that Marcus raised, and this is not to allow queries. Is vocab considered?
No.
Okay. So it's just queries. So the only question is whether it's relative or absolute IRI or a query in ID. I'm reluctant to remove query because I've seen the Drupal people use site colon in the IDs for their IDs to specify the Drupal site.
Since we don't have base, the only way to get something that's close to base is to use queries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, I think we use that as an argument for why it's okay to not have base. Right.
Right.
Okay, so I would definitely not be in favor of removing queries from ID. That'd be a pretty big minus one on that.
Are you sure Drupal is using it that way?
We need to check. We should check with them. But when I talk with Lynn a number of times and Stefan, they were using site colon in IDs to basically specify the site, the Drupal site. It might not be that important to them, but I think it mattered when they were in content staging. So all they would do is they would switch site colon to the production site and the staging site. And most of the document basically was left untouched when they did that. And I think they'd want to continue to do that, but we should definitely check with Lynn and them to make sure that that's what their needs are.
Lynn is online.
Okay.
She will call in.
Let's see. IDE. So the other thing, Marcus, that you were discussing here is that type allows absolute IRI, term, query, and vocab relative. Right?
What's the question?
I'm reading over your proposal. The value of type is interpreted as decided in 162, i.e. it's an absolute IRI, or it's a term, or it's a query, or it's a vocab relative. Right?
Hi there.
Yeah, that means...
Hi, Lynn. So Lynn, we were discussing removing queries from ID, but I was reminded that I think Drupal wants to be able to use queries in ID, so site colon slash node slash one. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true.
Okay, all right, then I don't think it's a good idea for us to remove it. Specifically
do you
because
need that,
of...
Or could you replace that with relative RIs easily?
Sorry, what was that?
Do you need that behavior, or could you easily replace it with relative RIs, for example?
I guess in the ID we would be able to, I mean, we can even use absolute URIs because the size of the context doesn't matter as much, I don't think, because we can cache that across different entities. So I think that that actually would, I guess it would be okay for us to not have queries there.
Okay.
So if you didn't have a query,
like name expands to schema name, where schema would be then expanded, right?
No, we're talking in IDs, like in the body of your JSON-LD documents. Yeah, you'd have at ID, and then you would have to use an absolute IRI, period.
Oh, okay.
You could not use a query there. Or a relative IRI, yeah, sorry.
I haven't thought much about that.
You guys are using it for content staging right now, is that right? So site one colon and then /node/1 would change based on whether you're in staging or production. Site one.
Well, I would strongly discourage that kind of use of prefixes. It would just be the size issue. And I'm trying to think if we could always assume that relative URI is appropriate there. Mm-hmm. And I honestly can't say for sure. I'd have to think about it more.
Okay. So we're getting rid of terms. We're getting rid of terms in ID because one could confuse a relative IRI with a term and end up using the term instead of the relative IRI, so that would be bad. So ID in the future is only going to take either absolute IRIs relative and relative IRIs, so that's one option. Or it's only going to take absolute IRIs or queries.
Okay. I think that it's probably okay for us to just do absolute IRIs and relative. I think that should be fine because that would be fine in content deployment because you would still the libraries like Marcus's library, would that handle the expansion of a relative URI or relative IRI? Would the processor handle it, or would that be handled by the client application?
No, it expands the relative IRI in expansion.
Okay.
The processor handles it.
And the advantage of that would be that you could also compact absolute IRIs to relative IRIs because you don't risk a term collision.
So basically what Marcus is saying is when you expand, you'd get the full IRI, but when you compact again, the algorithm right now is not going to compact that IRI. It's going to keep it as the full expanded IRI. But with this change, when you compact again, it would compact down to the relative IRI, thus saving you space. So it would round trip in a way that you'd expect it to round trip.
Yeah, I guess that's okay for us. I'd say that's fine.
Okay. All right. I'm still a bit hesitant because of the whole base thing. Since we don't support base, the only way for somebody to achieve a base-like functionality is to have a query in that spot.
Mm-hmm. I don't think there's not really a problem with queries, though. The problem is with terms, because a term could be confused with being a relative IRI, but a query won't be confused with being a relative IRI. It's unambiguous.
Yeah, so I guess there are two parts of this. We've removed the term issue. Like, you can't have terms in ID, right? That's done. So we can always expand and compact back to the previously defined IRI, right? So if they start out with a relative IRI, if we support relative IRIs and they start out with a relative IRI, we can expand to a full IRI and go back to the relative IRI, no problem. Right. The issue is now if we're going to remove queries, how do people get base-like functionality in ID? And I think the answer to that is that they can't. There's no base-like functionality in ID now.
Is that really a problem?
I think it is. I mean, that's why base is useful in so many other. Every other RDF syntax has a base equivalent, which is there because you might, in fact, want the same document to come from some other place but not change its meaning. So fixing the base is a way to do that. Now, we decided to not use base, but the reason for that was we felt that the query prefix mechanism basically was an equivalent that made more sense for the purpose of JSON developers. So if we remove that, then we've removed any ability to be able to describe a document without either using absolute IRIs or queries, really. So I think query makes sense there, and I don't see the reason to remove queries from being used for ID. That's not the same problem as with term.
Yeah. I agree.
Fine.
I mean, the good thing with this is, I mean, it gives the Drupal folks two mechanisms that they can choose, they can pick from, relative IRIs and queries. Yeah, and I feel a little hesitant from removing this base-like functionality as well. So
the only thing is that sometimes if you're going to compact something, you end up having a query where you don't really want to have a query, but you want to have a relative IRI, for example.
Well, could we prioritize what's used for compaction to just always try a relative IRI first, and if that doesn't work out, go to a query? So you always try to compact to a relative IRI first, and then if that doesn't work out, use a query.
Just for ID, or also for time?
Backwards is the way that the algorithm works right now.
Yeah.
So you always pick a query first and then you do a relative IRI? That's the way the algorithm works right now?
Yeah, I think it looks there. And then if it can be vocab relative, then it tries to do it vocab relative. And otherwise, if it's document relative, it tries to do it document relative.
Well, currently we never compact anything to a relative IRI.
Yeah, that might be the ordering we do it in the expansion algorithm. I think that was the idea, though, to use the same ordering for compaction. It would certainly be odd, I think, if we expanded using one set of ordering but compacted using another.
Yeah, I agree.
I think I think the thing that matters is does the thing round trip to something that's not surprising to the developer, and I think that list of rules might be surprising to the developer because they might start out with they will most likely start out with a relative IRI, and if they compact down to a query, that's an issue, right?
Yeah.
It seems to me that we should be compacting down to the simplest thing, which means that we should be trying relative IRIs first, and then we should try vocab, and then we should try query.
I think that the vocab and document relative are sort of mutually exclusive options.
That's true.
So those two sort of go together. Or it could be that you compact to the shortest result.
Yeah, I was also thinking that. But then you've got kind of this heuristic that's in there. It's a little more complicated. I mean, it might be ideally that's what. I think that unfortunately this really depends on the use case. Some developers are going to want to always compact the queries. Other developers are going to always want to compact the relative ones. Or there'll be others that want a mixture of the two based on the what looks nicer when they compact. So yeah, I think then what we have to do is just pick one mechanism and just go with it.
The developer has control of the. The context. So if you're compacting and you specify a term in the context which would map some aspect of your document base, then that's something they can decide to do.
That's
so that I think that sort of argues for doing the query base first in order to pick up their intention. And then if it's not there, then we try to do a document relative.
Yep. Okay. Well, that's convincing to me. Marcus, Francois, any feeling on this?
Well, I mean, there are cases where it makes sense for the vocabulary, for example, to specify a base prefix, so to say, but don't have that apply to at ID because there you want to have relative RIs. So, for example, in the Drupal case, I could imagine that you have the vocabulary which stays at the same site, but the data gets moved to a different server and the RIs in at ID should be moved to that different server, whereas the vocabulary should stay at the old server. I don't know. And that's, I think, in quite a lot of web services, that's what's desired. So you don't want to move to vocabulary,
but it's clear that we do not want to use vocabulary for compacting the IDs.
No, by vocabulary, I just meant the vocabulary namespace or whatever you call it. I didn't mean at vocab.
So that someone might have defined a term in a context which happens to be the same, share some prefix with the document base, and when you're moving it, you don't want to pick up that term. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not too convinced by that. I think we spent quite a lot of time coming up with odd examples that sort of satisfy the consequences of the algorithms without considering what the actual use cases are. So I think a simple rule, I think in order to be symmetric with expansion, it makes sense that we look at queries before we look at either vocab or document base.
Okay.
Because you can always affect that by not having a prefix that overlaps.
Just to make sure we're all on the same page here, the order of operations when expanding for ID is you try a query first. If that doesn't work, you see if it's a relative IRI. You expand it as a check to see if it's a relative IRI, and then expand it as a relative IRI. If that rule fails, then it's an absolute IRI, right? Order of operations when compacting an ID is you check to see if you can compact it as a query. If that fails, you check to see if you can compact it as a relative IRI, if it matches the document base, and if it does, you just chop off the document base, and you have a relative IRI left over, and if that fails, it's an absolute IRI.
Except that we start with term before looking for curie in each of those cases.
Wait a second, but term, we don't do terms for ID, right?
Okay, for ID, right, we don't do that.
Well, yeah, I'm only talking about ID
so
here, not talking
the generic, about the the generic process is pretty much what you said, except we start with term.
Right. So curie, and then relative IRI, and then absolute IRI. Marcus, you've written something different in there, but I think that we're...
No, it's first absolute IRI, then relative IRI. Because if there is a colon, you treat that as an absolute IRI. So first you split
you
up the colon...
You can have a colon in a relative IRI.
Well, but
like
we split the colon, check the prefix. If there is no prefix, we treat it as an absolute IRI.
Yeah, but that still might be a relative IRI.
Yeah.
Because colons can be used in the path portion of an IRI.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at least currently we don't check that.
Well, the algorithm is not correct. We can't check for a colon. You can't do that when you're checking to see if something's a relative IRI or an absolute IRI. The only thing we can definitely do is check to see, go ahead.
Don't we look to see if the after splitting the suffix starts with slash slash?
We can't do that either, I don't think.
Well, it doesn't get URNs.
Yeah.
But and maybe that's in the expansion that we do that in order to sort of short circuit constantly trying to expand the prefix.
Yeah. I think the only way to check between a relative IRI and an absolute IRI is check to see if the base of the document matches the front part of the relative IRI that you have. If it does, it's a relative IRI. If it doesn't, it's an absolute IRI.
How would you do that? A relative IRI doesn't match that first part.
Remember, I'm going from expanded form to compacting. Specifically, we're only talking about you've already got a full IRI, and you need to compact it. So you check.
I thought you were talking about expansion now, because you.
No, we talked about expansion was the first thing we talked about. IRC at 1136 or whatever order of operations when expanding for ID is curie, relative IRI, and then absolute IRI.
Yeah, and that's what I commented on. So it's curie, absolute IRI, relative IRI.
Oh, okay. I thought you were commenting on the compaction stuff. Okay. Wait.
So when expanding something, if there is a colon, we split at the first colon. Then we try to find the matching prefix. If there is no matching prefix, we treat that as an absolute IRI. Otherwise, we treat it as a relative IRI.
That was the check for curie.
So the one that I wrote up is if the value contains a colon, then split it in prefix and suffix. Unless prefix is underscore or suffix begin with slash slash, expand prefix recursively using the algorithm, set value to the expanded result appending suffix using textual concatenation. The blank node identifier and we're relabeling it, do the relabeling, otherwise its value. So then in the case where it doesn't contain a colon, look to see if it's vocabulary relative, if that was what was asked for. Otherwise, perform expansion relative to the document base if that was asked for. Otherwise, return value as is.
So the thing I'm concerned about is URN foo colon var being used as a relative IRI, where they use var as a relative IRI, and the document the document base is URN colon foo colon bar, or URN colon foo colon.
Yeah, so in this thing, you would split that, and you would get URN as the prefix, and then foo colon bar as the suffix. You would not find a mapping for URN, so the value would be URN colon foo colon bar. Would stop there.
Well, what I'm saying is that they've used in their ID. Their ID is foo colon bar.
Yeah, but your document's IRI is not URN colon.
Well, what I'm saying is it is. They've set it to that.
Well,
let's say
it's,
let's say it's this, and then the doc ID is, or the base is foo colon var colon. So that would...
Well, that's a standard case, right?
Yeah,
so
I guess
like
so that should work.
Example.
Yeah.
Right. That should work.
Yeah, that should work. Okay. Okay, so the algorithm as it is right now works, even for weird URN-type paths.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, all right. We might want to have a test case for this in there.
So back to the main question, do we want to have queries in at ID?
I think so, yes.
Yeah, I think we need to.
Should we put the resolution for that?
Yeah, we might as well. Support the following types. Value types are supported for at ID. Relative IRIs, absolute IRIs, queries, and queries, period, right?
Yeah, I think we just want to be sure it's document relative IRIs.
Yep.
Rather than not vocab relative IRIs.
Well, it's not vocab relative anyway. That's not the relative IRI. It's textual concatenation.
Yeah, I think document relative, it makes it unambiguous.
Yeah.
Is Francois, you're still on the call, yes? There we go. Okay. Okay. I think that's all we can. We're 15 minutes over time. We have two issues left, but they're fairly simple issues.
There's still a question for this issue, I think, and that's whether we compact absolute RIs for relative RIs.
I think yes. The answer to that's yes, right?
I would prefer to do that, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I believe so, too.
Okay. Proposal, when compacting, compact absolute RIs, attempt to compact absolute IRIs to document relative IRIs. Okay. Do we want to try and tackle issue 205 and 207? I have another 15 minutes. Marcus, Greg, Francois.
I have time, yeah. They should We should be able to resolve them rather quickly, I think.
Yeah, let's go ahead.
Okay. Issue 205, use the term URL instead of IRI in the API spec. I'm starting to feel that we should use URL because every single time we put IRI into a spec, we get a wave of people complaining that we've used IRI and that web developers don't know what an IRI is. This is also the position of the WebWG. So the HTML spec uses URL everywhere. The people that tend to use IRI are the more pedantic spec writers at W3C, myself included.
The only thing I just want to be sure we don't somehow adopt the URL processing rules from HTML5. That's my concern about URLs. But if it's just about a matter of basically stating up front that for the purposes of this specification, the terms URL and IRI would be considered equivalent, and then just use URL every place. I think that matches the expectations of developers and, frankly, makes it clear that it's linked data. It enhances what we want to do.
Yep. Yeah, I agree with everything Greg just said. Yeah, we're basically just aliasing URL to mean IRI in the spec. Marcus, Francois, any concerns about doing that?
No, I'm fine with doing that. I just wouldn't like the second part of your proposal to say we mean it as defined or as used in RDF, because I think that's more confusing than it helps.
Okay, so let's see. Okay, so with the proposal, include the text throughout the specification, the term URL means IRI, as defined in RFC, blah, blah, blah. So there's a problem with the IRI RFC, which is the whole reason. Do you want to just refer to 3987?
I think
it's RFC 3987.
The only reason why we want to use URL is because web developers are more familiar with it, right?
Yep. Yeah.
So
if we don't want to change the meaning of IRI, we have to refer to RFC 3987.
So do we say that that's the reason why we use URL in the spec?
Yeah.
But we need to make it clear that there is no normalization of URLs.
Yeah, and I don't think
no unescaping, no normalization performed.
Yeah, I don't think we say that anywhere in the spec. Right.
I believe that Turtle normalizes URLs to remove Unicode sequences.
Unicode sequences. That's like Snowman for
/ U0023 or whatever.
I don't think we should even.
I think their reasons for doing it are for legacy purposes because it's commonly been used with text plain, and we don't have that consideration.
Yeah, I don't think
it shouldn't
should
be an interoperability issue, since if you get it out of a Turtle processor, it will have already been unescaped. So, but I think we do need to explicitly say that there is no processing of the URLs.
There is no processing of URLs. There is no processing of URLs in JSON-LD to perform
other than for expansion. So I think if you're creating a URL that might include the normal URL normalization as part of the expansion, right? If you have a relative URL and you are applying it to a document base, the result of that, and the document base included, say, dot segments, then I think the result of expanding it would be a URL that did not have dot segments, because we refer specifically to the algorithms, the IETF algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
But we probably need to have tests for that.
Okay, I'm trying to write the proposal up, and that's a pretty. Let's break this into two parts. Include the text throughout the specification. The term URL means IRI, as defined in RFC 3987. The reason we use URLs is because it is more familiar to web developers, and then we use the term URL everywhere in both specifications. So that's the first proposal.
I just request we refrain from updating the documents until we resolve the algorithm issue, so that we don't get too far out of step.
Okay. And then Greg, I'm having a hard time figuring out how we should word the proposal you just talked about, which is basically JSON-LD. And the JSON-LD processor will not process URLs other than to change them from relative to absolute URLs. I mean, that's kind of...
Yeah.
So something to that effect, proposal, JSON-LD processors do
well,
not...
Well, I think in particular, they do not adhere to the processing requirements from HTML.
Okay. JSON-LD processors do not modify URLs other than to translate between relative and absolute URLs. Specifically, they do not implement the URL processing rules as outlined in the HTML5 specification.
Yeah.
I think we do modify language tags.
We lowercase them.
Yeah, so we should probably.
But those aren't malformed. I don't think a language tag, which difference in case.
Yeah,
is
I guess
malformed.
I would guess malformed means like 573-8, which is clearly not a TCP/47 tag. And Marcus Francois, plus one, minus one, the latest proposal. JSON-LD processors do not modify URLs. Any reason for the plus zero there, Marcus, that you want on the minutes?
No, not really. I just don't think it's necessary to mention it explicitly, and I don't think it's necessary to reference HTML5 explicitly.
Right.
But I'm fine with including it.
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion at the W3C about this right now. I'd rather be clear than kind of leave it. Okay, next issue is issue 207. And here's the link to that. So the question is, for free-floating values,
free-floating values have never resulted in RDF being generated.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that we've sort of the data model does not really the syntax allows them to be expressed, but they're not considered to be a part of the data model, as I recall.
So no, it's actually the other way around. The data model allows them, but we said authors should not use that feature, and the grammar currently says that, for example, the value of at graph should be a note or must be a note, and we never enforce that, basically. And that's the only case where free-floating values could appear. So I think it might even be more appropriate to throw an error during expansion. Because it's a grammar validation, now I don't find the word.
Well, I don't know if we should stop, we shouldn't stop processing because of this, right? Because it can be easily just ignored and the processor can continue. So that's why I think we probably shouldn't just raise an error, because it can be safely ignored.
Well, you lose data.
Yeah, but that's, you lose data if there's a prefix that's not declared or a term that's not declared. Losing data doesn't, we don't stop the processor when we lose data. At least that's the way we've been operating, right?
Well, the thing we have been operating is we lose data if we can't represent it in the data model. But we can represent this in the data model, but the syntax currently disallows it. So either we change the syntax
I think if the syntax disallows it, then the algorithms should not be able to produce it. The purpose of allowing them is so that we can conform to documents that might include that. But the result of, in my case, flattening is the one that has come up to bite me, we should not have as a result of that free-floating nodes.
Well, I think the concern is that someone can just author this stuff, right? They can just author a flattened form and they can put a free-floating node in there. So what do we do in that case?
So I think it gets swallowed either in expansion or in flattening.
Right. But I don't think we should kick out an error because of it.
I agree.
Okay. So, Marcus, you think in order to not kick out an error, we need to change... I don't think we need to allow it in the...
No, we need to disallow it in the data model, I think. No, maybe that's not even true. Maybe we should just add a statement that they are dropped.
We lost Mono.
Yeah.
It's probably that 2-hour thing that I think has come to bite him before. I think the RDF working group would be happy if it was excluded from the data model, because that's, you know, the feeling is to try to be as close as possible to the RDF data model, and if this is an area where we hang out, certainly for no really good reason, then I think removing it puts us closer to the right direction.
Yeah, but we still have free-floating nodes.
Well, so I'm confused about what we're disallowing from the data model. Just valued nodes, or?
Well, in the data model,
we're being picked off by the Astron box.
So the thing is, in the data model, we currently allow nodes, free floating nodes, and the node might be a value or an IRI. And here we are talking about disallowing values, so add value.
I think
we're
talking about disallowing both, right? Because why would we just? I mean, I think if we're going to go that way, we're talking about disallowing both free floating values and free floating IRIs. Neither are allowed in the data model.
Which I think is reasonable.
Yeah. I think it was kind of nice that you could make this existential statement about something, but we don't have a use for it right now. And there goes Marcus.
Well, I mean, you can make an existential statement about something, but just to do that, if you're making a statement about something, you've got a subject and an object. What we don't allow is free-floating nodes that are not connected.
You mean in order to make an existential statement about something, you say the subject is the IRI, value is exists, or the property is exists, and the thing is true, the object is true or one or whatever.
Well, you make some, you have some predicate relationship between two entities.
Okay.
In the absence of that, you don't have a you don't have a node which does not connect to anything else. It doesn't mean anything in a graph.
Well, you can argue it the other way, but I don't think it's we're getting into like highly pedantic territory. So I'd rather stay away from that. So does anyone object to disallowing free-floating values or free-floating IRIs from the data model? Okay.
Well, I'm more interested, how do we handle that then? Do we drop it in expansion?
We drop it in expansion.
Yeah.
Without throwing an error.
Without throwing an error. I mean, we drop it anywhere we detect it, right? Because someone could have expanded form where they do that. You could have compact form where somebody does that. You could have flattened form where somebody does that. So I think specifically.
Well, we just need to drop it in expansion because we always expand every input.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So that's where the rule goes. So the two proposals are disallow free-floating values and IRIs in the JSON-LD data model. If a free-floating value is detected during expansion, drop the value or free-floating.
So when you expand, if there's no active property and you have either a value or a node without properties, then you return null. Is that how that is?
Yeah, I believe so. Something like that.
Yeah, so if you have, for example, add graph, and then the value of that is just an add ID object with no other properties, you drop that object.
Yeah.
And we have to take into consideration that there might be an annotation, for example, or terms which don't expand to anything.
I think this is a case perhaps where we want to enumerate the use cases and how they should work, and that's where the time's best spent.
Mm-hmm.
And then that allows us to see what the minimal algorithm changes are that are necessary in order to pass that.
Right. So is there? Do we want to do the proposal and then go through the enumerations to make sure we catch everything? Marcus, yeah, I would expect that that's correct.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, okay. I would be fine with it.
Okay, so plus one, minus one. All right, and then we need to go into that and define all the cases. But I believe that is the last issue. Is that correct? At least before we get a huge slew of new ones coming in before last call.
Hopefully not too many.
All right, well, I think perhaps between now and next week we can, if people have a chance to go through and evaluate the various different ways of stating the algorithms, if we can include that, merge the documents back together, and then we can start to implement some of these resolutions, then we're pretty close to having a last call ready document.
Yep, that sounds good. That's the plan then. All right, great. Thanks again, everyone. And especially thanks for each of your input and help over the past several many years. It's been I'm incredibly thankful that you guys are helping put all of this stuff together. It certainly wouldn't be as great as it is without you, Marcus, or you, Greg, or your input, Francois, as well as the other folks that aren't here. So yay. All right, so we'll meet again next week and see where we are on progress on getting these docs for the tour's last call.
Now, as usual, they're going to want probably a good summary of where we are in JSON-LD tomorrow on the RDF working group call.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to come in to do that, otherwise Marcus or I will try to get through it.
Sure. I mean, I think you guys pretty much know. I mean, we're basically done with issues. We're doing a lot of spec editing. We hope to have both LCs ready by the end of this month. If not, we definitely think we can have the JSON-LD syntax document done by the end of this month, and then maybe the API document would follow, 2 weeks after that. But we believe we're on track to get two LC documents by the end of January. Yeah, I think that's all the update needs to be. It's I think pretty straightforward. All right. Anything else? All right. Thanks, guys. Have a good week. Talk to you all
you
later on. Bye.
Bye.